The Girl and the Tiger.
She said, I have a question about a tigress. And what her email said was that a mother tiger had gone missing and the cubs were in her grandparents' village and she was going to go rescue them.
That's naturalist, author, and award-winning wildlife filmmaker Paul Rosalie. We talk with him about how a real-life encounter with a tiger turned into a page-turner of a novel. His book is The Girl and the Tiger. But first, we explore the relationship of water to people and people to water. We talk with journalist and historian Jim Rumanier about his book, Water Connections. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Water. We can't live without it. But how should we live with it in a time of climate disruption? In his book, Water Connections, Jim Rumanier explores how bodies of water have been affected by changes in technology, economic values, new forms of pollution, new ideas about nature, and the unintended consequences of human action. The book is as much about people as it is about water, with stories about conservationists, artists, government officials, fishermen, scientists, and ordinary citizens. Jim Rumanier is a journalist and historian who lives in Roxbury, New Hampshire. Well, Jim Rumanier, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this book, Water Connections, you start this book with a trip down Roaring Brook. Tell us where it is, and what does it tell us about the history of the places that it goes through?
The brook that I referenced there is in southwestern New Hampshire, outside of the city of Keene, a small city near Vermont. And the brook runs through forested areas and connects two reservoirs that are created for the city of Keene. But the water, the stream, and the reservoirs are located in the small town of Roxbury, where I live. You look at this stream and you can see a history of water power, of watershed protection, of water contamination. You see different aspects of our relationship to water. And studying that particular stream led me to explore other streams, many of them in New England, to get a sense of our complex relationship with inland waters.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into this project. What's been your connection to water?
There was a bicentennial celebration of our tiny town. By tiny, I mean 211 people. And so in 2012, the town celebrated its bicentennial. I had a background in publishing, so I offered to organize a commemorative booklet, and I wrote an article for that booklet. And it was about how watershed protections around the stream, that is to say Roaring Brook, and the two reservoirs, in addition to a federal flood control dam that's also in town, how these watershed protections assured that most of the land around in Roxbury would never be developed. So the water, in essence, influenced the character of the town by assuring that it would forever be pretty green. And once I completed that article, I went down and spent more time with the stream, and I thought, well, if water could define the character of a town in that way, was there any other way that water could influence us? And that led to discoveries and research into the full range of our relationship. That includes water power, floods, flood control, and the like. It's not just a current story, but there's a lot of history there, going back to the early part of the 19th century when water power was part of our industrial revolution, in fact, powered our earliest industrial revolution.
And the focus of your book, Water Connections, is conservation, which most people, as you point out, think of as conservation of land. But you say the root of it is conservation of rivers. Why?
Sometimes we tend to view things in our life in isolation, when in fact everything's connected. And so the land is connected to the water. And I found that particular relationship there was one I hadn't taken fully account of, and I found it fascinating to explore it. Here's an interesting point that's, it's not in the book, but it's part of my research. I mean, there's a lot of the research that didn't make it into the book. But there's a study in the Northwest by a scientist who remarked that for fish, during times of the year, much of what fish eats is insects that are land-based. That would be like bees and wasps and other insects falling into the water. And conversely, much of what birds eat, and they're land-based or air-based, much of what they eat comes from the water. That is to say, the insects that are born in the water. So there's this relationship between the two, and I like the holistic feel of it. And so that really powered me through this entire book.
Yeah, and you said before that you go into the history of things, and one of the histories that you look into is the story of the Fulton Steamboat and the Supreme Court ruling on the Interstate Commerce Clause. Why is that important to this story?
Well, again, here's a case where what happens on land is related to what happens in water, and what happens in water is what happens to land. And I'll explain that right here. We all grew up in elementary school learning about Robert Fulton and the introduction of steamboat travel. And so he, in the early part of the 19th century, began running steamboats up and down the Hudson River. And his business thrived in part because he had received a monopoly license from the state of New York. Well, other steamboat operators got upset about that, and they sued him, and the case eventually wound up in the Supreme Court of the United States in 1824. Daniel Webster, who was a New Hampshire native and somebody in American history, he argued the case of the upset steamboat operators. And the Supreme Court ruled for the contestants, that is to say, for the unhappy steamboat operators who were angered at the monopoly. And the significance of the ruling was that waters are essentially federal concerns. And so an individual state cannot establish a monopoly or any kind of control over a particular river to the exclusion of anybody else. In essence, what happened here was that the Supreme Court defined the navigability of waters as a relevant term in determining how the federal government regulates commerce. So the point there is the government said that the federal government can control and have a word in the rivers and waters of the United States. And so that applied to riverboat commerce. But the significance here is that nearly 100 years later, there were some people in New Hampshire and in other parts of the East, that is to say, principally in the Appalachian regions, who were upset with what loggers were doing to hillsides. And by hillsides, they were stripping them bare of trees, leading to erosion that set settlement into rivers and ultimately resulted in floods downstream. So all this hillside cutting by lumber barons was damaging the land and such. So the people in New Hampshire and Appalachian regions went to Washington, D.C. and said, please, Congress, buy up these lands from the logging barons so that we can prevent them from doing such terrible things to the mountains and hillsides around in our country. Well, the reception in Congress at that time was very poor. The government was not used to, had no history of buying private land for the purpose of preserving it. All the big parks out west, they had been really cut out from land that the government had already claimed. But here in the east, this is all private land that the lumber barons are working on. So there was an inspired congressman from Massachusetts who argued that there was a constitutional basis for the government buying up private land. And the basis for that was that ruling in 1824 that referenced the safety and federal government's responsibility for waters. In essence, the congressman, whose name was John Weeks, argued that the rivers had to be protected from being ruined by all the sediment and silt, and the only way to do that was to buy up lands around the rivers, all the watershed lands around them. That led to what was termed the Weeks Act, a significant act that was approved by Congress, signed by President Taft, and that ultimately resulted in the preservation of 25 million acres of open space east of the Mississippi. Here was a case where, you know, concern about land led to the protection of water, and water concerns about water led to the protection of land.
Now let's talk about another kind of way into conservation that has also been controversial in places. Let's talk a little bit about reservoirs. You talked, Jim Rumenier, in Water Connections about the Quabbin Reservoir in Massachusetts, and I used to live very, very close to that reservoir. There was a huge amount of local resentment of the reservoir because, A, you're not allowed to recreate there. B, the water did not go to our local area, but it went to Boston. And C, that reservoir drowned five towns that were very important to that place. And yet, we need reservoirs. So talk a little bit about reservoirs, what they do other than just giving us water and helping to conserve, you know, the land around them. And what are some of your thoughts about, you know, the right way and the wrong way to do reservoirs?
Well, we need reservoirs because we can't drill for water every place. For example, in old areas where there was a industrial activity going way back, there's pollution down there, so you can't drill a well there. And also our population in urban centers is such that you can't build reservoirs there. So you have to build large reservoirs in outside areas. And as you pointed out, that could lead to terrible resentment. In this particular case, there were four or five towns in western Massachusetts that were drowned to make room for this huge reservoir that was going to serve Boston and neighboring communities. Well, the question then leads to what happens after you dam up rivers and build this large reservoir. Well, in the case of Quabbin, an unintended or unexpected consequence was that there was quite a bit of natural setting that now had been preserved. Now it was almost like parkland. It was what was called a wilderness that was not planned. Well, one way to protect that wilderness was, in the case of Quabbin, was to prevent hunting on it. So one unintended consequence was that deer, no longer hunted, were growing in population in huge numbers, and deer like small saplings. They like to eat vegetation and such. And so there was the very real prospect dating back to the 1950s, early 1960s, early 70s, that the deer were going to destroy the watershed by eating all the trees. Therefore, there'd be erosion and sediment running into the reservoir and therefore ruining the thing. So there was a debate about how to get rid of all these deer. And the debate ran, the whole options were there. They included bringing in mountain lions. They included wrapping trees with plastic. They included poison. Well, ultimately, it was decided, let's go for a hunt. Well, you know, there are people who like hunting, and there are people who don't like hunting at all. But the real fact was that reservoir people had to do something about protecting the trees that were providing the coverage all around the reservoir itself. And the hunt was started and eventually was reduced to just a couple of days and has rendered its service to the reservoir function. That is to say, you no longer have those destruction of trees and therefore sediment running into the reservoir. But this particular concern about what to do around reservoir lands is not unique to that particular reservoir. There's one reservoir in New Hampshire, for example, around that serves the city of Manchester, where in order to protect the quality of the water, the people who were responsible for the reservoir wanted to make sure that human behavior around the reservoir did not degrade that quality. And that included concerns about people who ride horses on reservoir land. And if their horses occasionally have to go poop, what happens to all that poop? Does that run into the reservoir and degrade the quality of water there? So there, in fact, is a recently passed law for that particular reservoir land that horses are confined to certain paths, but if they go off those paths, they're going to have to be outfitted with diapers. And you can imagine that this is not a thrilling decision for people who ride horses, but nevertheless a reflection of the kind of conflicts that can happen around water when you're concerned about the quality of it.
Now, you mentioned how, you know, the poop can stormwater runoff, basically, the problem of contamination from stormwater runoff. Stormwater runoff is probably the number one contaminant called, you know, non-point source pollution. You expend a good amount of ink in this book about it, and it's something I'm very interested in, living in a coastal community where our marsh waters and our bays are hugely impacted by stormwater runoff that creates nitrogen pollution and algal blooms.
That's correct. And it's one of recent area of recent activity. Until very recently, until maybe 20 years ago, when we thought of pollution, we thought of factories or septic systems that leak. We could identify sources of pollution. But then we came to realize that once you've got those places cleaned up, we came to realize that pollution can come just from our general ambient environment for what we put from what we put on the land or on our roads and such. In 1987, a significant date in pollution awareness in our country, Congress upgraded the Clean Water Act from the 1970s, and that particular revision of the law required localities to look out for, as you point out, non-point pollution. That is to say, runoff that comes across streets and lawns, that carries with it all the evidence of material human civilization. By that I include animal waste, fertilizer runoff, oil, grease, paving and such. And so one chapter in the book addresses a really outstanding case of urban runoff control in the city of Dover, New Hampshire, where a significant effort was laid out to reduce runoff from land and lawns and do what is necessary to cause rain to settle into the ground near where it falls, as opposed to channeling the rainwater off to some other place. Now, this supports the idea of building rain gardens and reducing the width of roads, for example, reducing the amount of pavement you have. The idea here being to reduce runoff by, as I say, causing rain to settle into the ground near where it falls.
But this whole issue also came out after Tropical Storm Irene, which was absolutely devastating to your neighboring state, Vermont. You talk about that as well. And first of all, tell us what the impact was, and then what some certain towns, how they reacted to it, and then how that really wasn't the best way of dealing with it.
Yes, well, Tropical Storm Irene in 2011 devastated much of the East Coast of the United States, but particularly it hit the state of Vermont, an inland state. It has no, you know, ocean coast. We tend to think of hurricanes as doing significant damage only in terms of coastal communities, but here's Vermont. They were recently wiped out. Huge amounts of rain fell and substantial flooding occurred. I'm going to bring up a particular experience there that is significant to our understanding, not entirely regarding pollution, but also flood control. The longest river that's contained entirely within the state of Vermont is called Otter Creek. It starts in the bottom of the state and flows north, and on the way it passes through Rutland, which is a pretty big city, and then 30 miles later, Otter Creek passes through Middlebury, a smaller town, and then into Lake Champlain. So the rainwaters and floodwaters in Otter Creek during that storm did a significant number on the city of Rutland. Historic floods resulted. And then from that point on, it's significant damage too. And from that point, Otter Creek traveled for the 30 miles to get to Middlebury. And you would imagine, wow, if Rutland were hit badly, what would have happened to Middlebury? It would be even worse. But in fact, Middlebury experienced very little flooding whatsoever. And so the question is, how come? And the answer is, what happened to the river between Rutland and Middlebury? And what happened was it overflowed into swampland and floodplain, places that had not been built upon. That is to say, these are generally called the Otter Creek swamps. And here the land around the river soaked up the floodwaters and then gradually released them. So the peak of the flood in Middlebury came more than a week after the peak of the flood in Rutland, and evidence was given there that if you let the land around rivers absorb waters, absorb floodwaters, well, then you're going to reduce the incidence and possibilities of flood downstream. So that's a lesson. But there were some towns that had never learned that lesson. And their practice going way back had been to dig out rivers after floods or to straighten rivers. I mean, in the rural state of Vermont, you wouldn't think there'd be a whole lot of river engineering going on. But in fact, 70% of the rivers in the state of Vermont in one place or another have been straightened over the years. You say, how come straighten a stream? Well, if you're building roads, you like a straight road or a straight railroad. You don't like a meandering one. So let's take the meander out of that particular river. Or if you're a logger with a mill operation and you want to float logs downstream, you prefer to have a straight river and not a meandering one where logs can get all hung up. So quite a few rivers, therefore, had been straightened. Well, a straight river delivers water faster than a meandering river. A meandering river, slightly overflowing, turning water this way and that, slows the rate of water, therefore reduces the incidence of really devastating floods downstream. But after Tropical Storm or Hurricane Irene, there were some towns that simply said, the damage from that storm is too much. We must go in there and again, as we have done in the past, dig out, ream out, bulldoze out our rivers so that they can be nice and deep and in some cases straightened so we can get rid of water fast enough without much thought given to what happens to the water once it's delivered downstream. So the legislature responded with some pretty significant legislation that has made Vermont one of the most river-wise states in the nation.
What was that?
Well, they said, look, folks, you can't do that anymore. If there's a storm that comes by and does, let's say, carve off the banks of a river, you're not allowed to go in afterwards and dig out the river and line it with rocks. You're just going to have to learn to live with it, maybe move some of your buildings away from where the river passes so they won't be subject to as many floods as before.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jim Rumenier about his book, Water Connections, What Fresh Water Means to Us, What We Mean to Water. So this is a form of restoration. I mean, we've talked about conservation, and this is restoration. You know, what's the best way to do it? One very important part of restoration of rivers has been the removal of dams to encourage a wild river, to encourage fish and fish habitat. Talk about how you've seen removal of dams and, or even fish ladders, I guess, in some places, to encourage the return of migrating fish, for example.
I'm going to tell a story here. It occurred after the book came out, but it's relevant to the topic, and that is, I live just outside the city of Keene, and I was editor of the newspaper there for quite a few years, so I'm familiar with things going on. And one of the things going on recently was a discussion about whether an old mill dam, pretty much in the center of town, whether that should be taken down or repaired and left up. And it was the state government that raised the question because it said, dams so old, it could fall apart someday and be subject to floods and therefore do damage downstream. That concern is based in part on the consequences of climate change because drenching rains have become more common in the Northeast as a result of climate change, and therefore dams just might get swept away. So the debate in town in a community gathering was what to do about this old dam. And I attended that and was asked at the outset, what did I think should happen to the old dam? And I should mention here that I'm quite active in historical preservation affairs. I'm president of the local historical society. I'm no longer editor of the newspaper. And given my history inclinations, I said, by all means, we ought to repair that dam and keep it up. And 45 minutes later, after the discussion of various options, including the installation of fish ladders and the like, we were asked again at our table, what do you think we ought to be done? And I surprised myself by saying, I think we ought to take that dam down. And you can leave up the bulwarks on the side to remind us of our industrial heritage. But here was the basis for my concern there. One was the installation of fish ladders would have essentially defaced the entire dam. When you picture a fish ladder, don't picture like a ladder you put on the side of your house. It's got a couple rungs on it. We're talking about some significant cement installations that looked simply awful. And so, you know, I raised the point that, you know, maybe the historical preservation has a point, but let's recognize that fish have an earlier claim on those waters than our old mill masters. So maybe we ought to take down the dam, let the water run free, find some other way to recognize our industrial heritage, but meanwhile, let the fish get back to the river.
You finish your book talking about citizen action to preserve the waters. So talk a little bit about what gives you hope. I mean, we certainly have seen a cleaning of the Connecticut River and of some other rivers, and we are also seeing the threats of the climate chaos that is hurting our water bodies. But what gives you hope now?
Well, first, I want to acknowledge that there are political leaders who can make change happen. But what was most inspiring to me in my research was the work at the citizen level, where citizens stomped their feet, stood up, and said, do something about it. There's a lot of noise around and in nonprofit river coalitions and watershed associations and lake organizations, where these people shout out and make and demand government action to clean up and take care of public waters. And the book details a couple of significant success stories in that regard. And the question raised by all that is, we have been able to change our ways around water, thanks in part to citizen action. The question is, with that background, do we have what's required of us to take action in an effective way regarding the newest threats to the quality of our waters? And by that I mean the escape of chemicals into waters that we know nothing about. I mean, in the news today, we're all concerned about a collection of chemistry called PFOAs or PFOSs. These are chemical substances that are used in the creation of consumer services and products that are very useful, like nonstick cookware and the like. And they have gotten into the water, and we do not know yet how to get them out of the water. So the question that's posed is, will citizens stand up and stomp their feet enough to force the government to regulate these chemicals and to place more demands on manufacturers so that they don't pollute waters with chemicals we know nothing about?
Well, this has just been a fascinating discussion with you, Jim Rumenier. Your book is Water Connections, What Fresh Water Means to Us and What We Mean to Water. I really enjoyed reading about the history and also some things that we haven't talked about here, and listeners will just have to get the book to read about, which are some very promising new water technologies that can help us as we transition to a renewable and greener future. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
And thank you very much, Francesca. It's been a treat talking with you.
Jim Rumenier had a 43-year career in journalism. He reported on economics for the Baltimore Sun before being named editor at the Keene, New Hampshire Sentinel. Next up, a thrilling novel that takes the reader into the forests of India, home to tigers and elephants, and the conflicts around them. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When a girl named Isha sent naturalist and author Paul Rosalie an email asking him what to do about two tiger cubs in India, he was in the Amazon and unable to respond. But the question stayed with him. He'd spent time in the ever-shrinking forests of India where there are few places left for a tiger to hide. He's seen the war man has waged on those forests and the creatures in them. He's witnessed the wrenching conflicts between conservationists, developers, and the tribal forest people stuck in between. So he decided to write a novel about it. The Girl and the Tiger is about a courageous teenager's crusade to save a tiger from capture and bring her to one of the last wild places in India. Paul Rosalie is a wildlife filmmaker, naturalist, and author. His previous book was a memoir, Mother of God. The Girl and the Tiger is his first novel. Well, Paul Rosalie, thank you for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This novel, The Girl and the Tiger, is about a young girl, Isha, who rescues a tiger cub that's lost its mother when villagers poison it. First, tell us about the setting and the part of India where this takes place, and then tell us about Isha.
Well, for the last 10 years or so, I've been working with tigers and tracking them through South India, and it's one of the most incredible stories I've ever found, and I think that's what drew me into it, was that, you know, in 1900, there were over 100,000 tigers in the world, spread out all across Asia into Russia and China and all through the Middle East. And then as we started cutting forests and cutting back habitat today, I mean, we're hovering just around 3,000, which is a drastic cut for tigers, and which puts one of the most inspiring, iconic species that we have on the brink of extinction. So tigers today, living in India, where there's more tigers than anywhere else, there's still, you know, these little fragmented bits of forest. Tigers have to migrate through those to go find other tigers and to find food. And so they're migrating across farms and villages and through backyards. And it's this incredible story of survival. You know, so many people are working on this, the story of the tiger and how to protect the tiger. And I was struggling with a way to translate all these things that I've seen to bring that to people, because I could have done this story nonfiction, but it just wasn't working. And then two things happened that really set off this book. And the first was that in central India, a tiger fell into a well, and the villagers found her there, and she was bruised and she was terrified. And the pictures of her face, it's just heart stopping to see this tiger's face, the desperation on it. And the forest department and scientists came and they took her out and they rehabilitated her and they let her heal from her wounds and they put a radio collar on her. And when they released this tiger, they named her Kala. And Kala, they realized because of her radio collar that she was migrating between all these farms and villages. And in the daytime, she would just sort of bed down in some bushes. And then at night, she'd be out like poaching goats or dogs or looking for whatever prey she could find. And it sort of really brought home how difficult the life of a modern day tiger is. And so all that was there. And of course, as I'm going around following these tigers, you also see the elephant herds are in the same position where they're so impactful on the environment and they require so much food and space and they have such complex families, but they have nowhere else to go. And so there's all these incredible things that I've seen, and those were floating out there until the day that a young student of mine that I'd actually met in my work in the Amazon, her and her family had come as tourists, and I had kept in touch, but this girl, Isha, sent me a message, an email. She said, "I have a question about a tigress." And what her email said was that a mother tiger had gone missing and the cubs were in her grandparents' village and she was going to go rescue them. And that was really the moment that I said, oh my God, this is how I could take people through this story. This is how I could allow people to sort of join tigers on their journey and sort of bring people into this narrative in a way that will reach more people than just, you know, the conservation community or people that are interested in wildlife. Make this something that can actually like be impactful for everybody through literature.
What happened to that girl and the tiger cubs, the real one?
It's unclear what happened to the tiger cubs. In the end, I sort of lost track of that storyline, because I was actually, when I got that email, I was deep in the Amazon and I was about to leave for a 6-week expedition in uncharted jungle. So that all sort of slipped away. But what stuck was that determination. In real life, Isha has this intense love of animals and this ability to inspire people to sort of stop what they're doing. You know, I work in the jungle where it's like, you know, there's poachers and gold miners and there's deforestation and corporations doing all these horrible things. And so you have to build up a certain amount of like heart callus. You know, they tell you if you see poachers with an animal, never buy the animal from those poachers, because you might be encouraging the poachers to then sell animals to other gringos. And when Isha was in the Amazon, which was ages and ages ago now, but there's a day, she was very young, she must have been 11 at the time, and we saw poachers, and they had these two ancient yellow-footed tortoises. These are these big land tortoises. And with tears in her eyes, she came to me and she said, you know, you have to do something. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, I can't. I said, you know, the professional thing to do is to just look the other way and, you know, try and protect the forest. And she said, yeah, but that's not going to help these tortoises. So she said, how old do you think those tortoises are? I said, I don't know, maybe 70, 80 years old. And she goes, so that story ends today because you won't do something. And it was that accountability of like, you know, no, someone has to do something. And if it's not you, then who's it going to be? And that energy also really set off this book, because in the book, this character is confronted with the fact that the mother tiger is gone and these tiger cubs, that no one is going to help them. They're either going to end up rotting in a zoo or they're going to end up killed by villagers. And this story plays out across India several times a year, where, you know, a tiger will get, just a few months ago, there was a horrible video that went around the internet where a tiger had gone into a village and these villagers surround it and they beat the tiger to death with poles. And someone was filming this and it's absolutely heartbreaking to watch. And leopards, tigers, elephants, the human wildlife conflict in India is like an all out war. So the idea of having a main character, especially a girl, especially a female hero, to me was really timely and really important, especially because of the real life things that happened. But that idea of that, you know, the greatest danger to saving the world is thinking that somebody else is going to do it. And that's what I think that it brought to this, to the main character of the story.
Wow, you've just said so much that is so powerful there. First of all, just take a step back and tell us a little bit about your work as a conservationist, as someone who's worked in the Amazon. You've worked also in India with elephants and tigers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in the Amazon, I'm the director of an NGO called Jungle Keepers, and we're currently protecting about 30,000 acres of Amazonian rainforest, which after everyone has spent the last few weeks united in horror about, you know, the Amazonian fires that are happening this year, the best way to put those out is to protect the ancient functioning jungle that's producing the rain clouds that keep the Amazon moist. That's really the only way to combat those fires. So I'm trying to protect ancient habitat. And within that habitat is the greatest biological diversity on Earth, the West Amazon. There's nowhere on Earth, no time in the fossil record when there was more life than in this spot. And we're losing it every day. So I've been working with an incredible team at Jungle Keepers and through my ecotourism company, Tamandua Expeditions. And we work with the local indigenous people, giving guys that would have been loggers or poachers or gold miners, we give them jobs as chefs, boat drivers, guides, all these other jobs that A, they like better, and B, pay better and are safer. And so we're really trying to empower the local people to protect their own environment. And so that's really the whole mission. That's my work as a conservationist. And of course I do, you know, films, I've done stuff with Netflix and Discovery Channel, but as an author, which is at the end of the day, my primary calling, the thing I care about the most, I want to tell stories about the wild, because for me, being out in the jungle in the Amazon and in India, that's what I care about the most. And I think that having those experiences, like, you know, 10 years spent in India, my wife is from India and we live 3 to 4 months out of the year, we're in South India. And so over the course of writing this book, you know, I really got to live with the tribal people that are being pushed out of their forests. I got to follow elephant herds. I was actually chased and very close to killed by a raging bull elephant. And the whole reason he was so angry is that his whole life people have been chasing him away from farms and cutting him out of his own forest. So I've really experienced this stuff firsthand. I've bled for it. But I really feel like the people alive right now, our generation together, is the most important one in history because you know, our rivers, our ecosystems, our wildlife, all of this stuff, you know, is what creates a healthy environment. And if we let this go a little bit too farther in the next few decades, it's really going to be irreversible. And so I think that pulling it back before it's too late makes this time the most important time that's ever happened.
And there's a parallel to the climate crisis there, really.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I write about in The Girl and the Tiger is the fact that, you know, if you look at a forest, people think of trees, you know, and then there's animals living in the forest. But really, the truth is that these forests were made by the animals. The deer are eating the grass and the small twigs and gardening the forest. The elephants are carrying seeds back and forth and really engineering the forest. And tigers are keeping balance over all of it. So these forests that the animals created were the things that influenced our climate, the things that gave us the resources to build ships and explore and start our civilizations. I mean, everything we have comes from forests and animals and ecosystems, as well as the ocean, of course. But today, as we burn the Amazon, that's having devastating effects on the climate. And in India, it's almost like we're seeing the ghost of climate future, because you're seeing a place where they've dammed so many rivers, they've cut so much forest that they're starting to see droughts. Their farmers don't have the correct rain patterns anymore. So they're feeling the negative effects of climate change already. And then that's very closely tied to what's happening in the forest. So this book for me, you know, yeah, it's an adventure story about a girl and a tiger, but it's also so much more than that, because it really is about the human connection to nature.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with naturalist, wildlife filmmaker, and author Paul Rosalie about his first novel, The Girl and the Tiger. One of the things you said just before, you talk about the forest people, the contradictions and the conflicts between, say, conservationists and those who are supporting the rights of the tribal peoples. You just said before there's a kind of war between the people and the animals. And, you know, you are talking about tribal peoples who are fighting the animals, and yet the tribal peoples themselves are being ejected, taken out of their forests. Their homes are being burned down as the forests themselves are being burned down by those who want to develop India. So untie this Gordian knot for us between the conflicting interests here and, you know, what can cut through it.
Yeah. So another very real life influence for the book was that my wife and I spent time with this tribal leader named Thimma. And that's the name I gave to the young Mahout boy who has the elephant in the story. And they were tribals. And so we got very, very intimate with them, and we got to see what they deal with. And really what's happening is that Indian society has cut these forests down so much that there's only a little bit of forest left. And of course, then you have conservationists going in and saying, well, my God, tigers and elephants, these things are going extinct. We must protect these forests. And we need there to be no people, because animals do need their space. And that's fair. However, at this point, the only forest that's left is just that. It's the last bit. So the tribal people are faced with being really forcibly evicted from their forests. And so you'll have these things where the government or corporations will come in and be like, okay, this is turning into a tiger reserve. You guys got to move. And you're taking people that live on roots and berries and collecting honey and that have elephants to do work with and that are extremely and inextricably tied to the forest. And you're just putting them out somewhere. And I've seen relocated tribals, their villages on just grassy hilltops where there's no forest, no water, just pure sunlight, harsh, harsh sunlight. And they're not ready. They're not equipped to get jobs and deal with the economy. And they have a very hard time transitioning out of that lifestyle. And it's one of the most horrible things I've ever seen, this displacement. And it's sort of tragically poetic, actually, that the people of the forest and the animals of the forest have been divided by the interests that want to destroy the forest completely. And so this divide and conquer by the government and by corporations to say, okay, you know, if the people and the conservationists are all one thing, they're much more powerful. So let's break that in half. It seems like it's been deliberately done, and both sides are losing. So that was another thing that I tried to weave into the book, was sort of this You know, imagine if the people of the forest and the animals could take back each other's sides and be back to back with guns blazing and go out against the things that are destroying the forest. And that part is fiction, because on the ground, it's a brutal conflict.
Is anybody doing something to, you know, what you're doing in the Amazon to give jobs to people to protect the forest? And is there any effort to do that in India, in an India that is now being run by a man that many call a fascist?
Yeah, I mean, in India, there's so many people trying to work with the tribal people, trying to empower them, trying to help them, trying to defend them legally when others try to push them out of their forest. But there's just so much that they're up against. And in the Amazon, it's quite easy to, in the Amazon, to go to a community and say, hey, we're going to work together. Do you guys want to try this? And they're like, well, we'd love a job. In India, it's far more complicated. The politics run deeper. It's just a more complex cultural landscape. And so it's not as easy. There's too many different stakeholders in every square inch because of the population. So, you know, groups like Survival International are trying to help the tribal people, and they're often posting news articles and social media posts about when conservation for wild animals costs forest people their livelihoods and how this is not conservation. And they're absolutely right. And at the same time, there's people on the ground in India that are fighting for the same thing. But that's the hurdle now, because if we could take the forest people and put them in, give them the power to really manage their own forests, I'm hoping that in the next few years we see that. But that's going to involve getting local indigenous tribal leaders educated and capable of competing and defending themselves in this like very complex modern landscape. So it's a really, really intense story. And of course, at the end of the day, you also have these species that are fighting for the same territory that can't represent themselves. A tiger or an elephant can't put on a suit and go address Parliament or Congress. They can't go become a lawyer. So you have to depend on the conservationists protecting them. Otherwise, their land will be taken out, because there's so much money to be made from the destruction of forests in terms of minerals and timber and water rights. And it's a really, really tough battleground right now.
Well, I guess I do want to ask about the current government, because are they doing anything to save the animals, or are they just giving it all to development? I mean, this is echoed in one of the characters in your book, who a man who is running for election and is, you know, this guy who wants to build a dam that will flood the tribal villages and the forest. Is there a better way to develop, and how does the current political climate in India, which way is it going to go?
Great question. So it seems like the traditional thing so far has been this thing where we allow a corporation to come in, or we allow a government project, you know, and when a road is built through a national park, the contractors and the politicians and a couple hundred guys get very, very rich, and then everyone else suffers. When a dam is built on a river, again, the developers get tons of money. What happens to the communities downriver? Their fish, their whole livelihood is taken apart. Their rain is going to react because there's going to be depleted precipitation. These projects that we allow to happen all over the world, including in the US, you know, we allow a few guys to get rich and impoverish everyone else. And that's what we're seeing with climate change as well. We're stealing from our children as we just destroy all these ecosystems. In India, I think, just like in the rest of the world, this old generation of politicians is very set on that archaic view of development, that there's a few ways that you can develop, and this is how we're going to do it. Whereas today we would say, well, if development means putting in a dam to power electricity for a city, but then downstream 100,000 people are going to lose their livelihoods, is that really development, or is that just theft? We have to reimagine these things, and that's happening. And one of the most important things that I've learned through my time in India is that here you have a country with 1 billion people. The challenges are so incredibly complex and intense, and the stakes are so high. But India still manages to have more tigers than anywhere else, more Asian elephants than anywhere else. And that's because Indian citizens care deeply about their wildlife, about their resources, about nature, and about their heritage, which encompasses all of that. And so what I'm seeing in India is that despite that there are these predatory corporate, you know, giants that are trying to come in and make all this money off of the land by destroying it, there are so many grassroots organizations. There are so many PhDs and local activists, and there are just incredibly passionate people that are fighting around the clock to protect all of the sort of natural wealth that India has and defend the tribal people and the wildlife and everything else. So in India, you have this paradox where you see this absolutely devastating destruction and sort of insurmountable odds, but then you also see these people fighting harder than they are anywhere else and doing miraculous things. So if it's possible in India, then it's possible anywhere. So in a sense, it's to me the source of greatest hope because it shows you how deeply people care about these things.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Rosalie about his novel, The Girl and the Tiger. It's based on true events. Now, let's go back to the book itself. You've talked about Simha, who is, you know, a young boy who works with elephants. He has an elephant named Hathi. Hathi was also the name of the king of elephants in the Jungle Book. Another elephant called Ramachandran. There is the tiger as well. All of these animals are also characters with intelligence, awareness, responsiveness, knowledge. Is this anthropomorphizing, or is this something that you're really tapping into in this book and saying to us, these animals have intelligence, they are part of us, we are part of them?
It's funny because a few people, even early reviewers on Goodreads, have commented and said that this book anthropomorphizes animals, or I didn't find it realistic. And that makes me laugh because there is nothing that an animal does or thinks in this book that isn't realistic. And when I say realistic, I mean like that I haven't either experienced or that isn't documented. So Ramachandran is actually a real elephant. He lives in Kerala and he really has killed a bunch of people, several cows, other elephants. He's a big, violent old tusker. And he's been incarcerated his entire life and beaten and chained and abused. And he's angry and he's furious. And so that was, again, that's a character I wanted to give voice to, because that kind of rage and that sort of tragic life is unfolding right now. He's chained somewhere and out behind a temple at this very moment. Timma's elephant Hathi, I wanted to give a nod to Jungle Book, but my wife and I actually met a young boy who had his own elephant and his parents were gone. And we've seen, you know, blind elephants. And I don't think, you know, in terms of the tiger even, everything that I write about is from my years of research on the ground. So everything can sort of be defended. I was very careful about not giving the animals emotions or thoughts or actions that could not or have not happened. So even there's a scene in the book where the elephant is sort of negotiating with them, saying, look, either you give me bananas or I'm going to push your car over. And that happened to me. That's just a direct, I didn't make anything up there. That was just me just swapping in something that happened to me. Tiger is mimicking dog calls to call them in. Tiger is holding a grudge and choosing to murder a certain person. 100%. We've seen it lots of times. And I think that because so many people live in cities, you know, you see animals on National Geographic or whatever it is, but most people don't have intimate contact, especially with wild animals, and their lives are so complex that we're really not able to. But there's a book that recently came out and it was called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And that's such a powerful statement because it really puts you in the position of thinking like, you know, if somebody put you naked in the jungle, could you survive? No, you'd be dead in a few days. You know, a mother tiger has to teach her young how to stalk, how to hunt, not to mess with a porcupine. These things are imparted, and animals actually have culture. There's examples of otters using rocks to break oysters. They'll float on their back and they'll put the rock on their stomach and they'll break the rock with an oyster. But if they're not taught by their mothers, they won't do that. And if you have families of otters that are in other locations, they might not have learned that. So just like, you know, we might have learned to use a spoon, different things develop independently. So people, I think, don't realize how complex animals are or how intense their emotions are. And that was one of the most important things that I wanted to bring into this book was the interactions that I've had with animals in the jungle and sort of give that sense in the story.
The story is based on science, but it also has a really powerful spiritual dimension, a moral dimension, which I think, you know, so often science and spirituality are seen as opposed to each other. You really bring them together in this book. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, there is a line in there where I said something about how, you know, in the jungle, the line between science and religion is not so easily, you know, discernible. And I've never felt like science disproves or is against spirituality. I think if anything, it vindicates it. You know, I've always felt like the jungle is my church, temple, whatever have you. But I think that nature is a very important thing in terms of the fact that we all come from it, the fact that it can and should transcend political boundaries and national boundaries. And like, it's the one thing that we all have in common. We all depend on these sort of base elements. It's a chemical, physical truth that can't be debated. And today there's so much chatter and debate and all this stuff. And it's like, I would love to see everyone united around the fact that, you know, we've lost 50% of the wildlife on this planet, that our resources, that we're challenging the resiliency of our resources to sustain us. You know, in our oceans, 3 billion people on Earth today still get their main source of protein directly from the oceans. And we're messing that up, you know, and it's like these things come standard with life on Earth. They come free. And we're messing things up on such a global level. And I think that for the characters in the story, whether it's a young person growing up with the intense stress of feeling like the world is ending and like humans are destroying all the beautiful, pure things, to the two older men who are, you know, sort of broken and need a chance to rekindle what keeps them alive, and the tribal people who've lost their way and are confused in this new landscape of like profit and survival and all this stuff. And really the jungle, that, you know, the jungle sort of uniting everybody. And to me, I think that's the spirituality of it, I think, is very important, right alongside the scientific truths of it.
And it's a beautifully written book. Paul Rosalie, The Girl and the Tiger. It has been such a privilege to talk with you. Inspiration and despair war with each other. I just cannot recommend this book highly enough. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful talking to you.
I'd like to read a little bit that expresses this. You're talking about your protagonist here, about Isha, and how she could hear all the heartbeats. The culpability of her entire species had taken up residence within her, poisoning every conversation, each ordinary pleasure, with the uncertainty of the guilt. And this is where you're talking about, you know, where she came from, you know. The death of rivers, the slaughter of the mockingbirds, the violent silence like a hurricane of nothing. Once I knew these things, what hope was there to enjoy anything, she says. Being told that you're part of a species that has reproduced like a virus until the world is dying robs you of all human dignity. And I was expected to go to school, to sit in a desk and fill out papers as if everything was fine. No one realized it was a funeral. You know who this reminds me of so powerfully is Greta Thunberg, because, you know, she did the school strike. She talks this way. I mean, when I first heard her, my heart leaped within me. I said, finally, somebody is saying this, just pure and simple, to the world's leaders. Talk about that.
Just personally, I mean, I grew up feeling that. I've always been, you know, sort of really passionate about wildlife. And I remember lying awake at night crying because my mother had told me that, you know, a certain species was about to go extinct. And just that really ugly feeling of like, you know, yeah, the world is ending and we're doing it. You know, my parents brought me to the Bronx Zoo where they show you, you know, these beautiful gorillas. And then you go into the next room and they show, you know, you hear the sound of backhoes and bulldozers, and they show you these, you know, these trees going over. And I grew up with a huge amount of stress, feeling like all the beautiful, incredible, pure, exciting stuff in the world was going to be gone before I even got to see it. And selfishly, that's what propelled me out into the career of rainforest conservation that I've gone out on, because I just couldn't bear to watch it and I couldn't bear that stress. And I think that today I've, you know, now I have younger kids. I'm in my early 30s and I have younger kids, you know, in college and high school reaching out to me, and they, you know, the messages I get on Instagram and across social media are like, you know, I'm filled with grief. I feel hopeless. what are we doing to this planet? You know, I mean, a few weeks ago, I put up a video from the Amazon where I was standing in a field of burning forest and screaming at the camera about, you know, how this is just unacceptable and it's disgusting. And that went viral and people all over the world saw it. And for a while, my life was filled with people reaching out going, you know, this is the end. I don't know how to deal with this. And it's like so many people are feeling this stress right now about how, like, you know, we just can't keep doing this to other creatures, to indigenous cultures, to the generations to come. It's just, you know, if you look at, you know, how a river filled with salmon that, you know, is replenishing the forests, that all the people in that region have free food every year that also feeds the bears, and everything is so connected, and we're ruining that amazing story. We're ruining the thing that really, I, you know, so many people are, you know, trying to find themselves spiritually or, you know, or whatever. This is what we've lost, the connection to nature. And so that's truly, truly why I, at the end of the day, what this book is about is rediscovering that, you know, in these, you know, sort of fallen times of environmental destruction. It's a, you know, story about someone saying, well, it stops here. I can't take it anymore. And I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, you're describing me, you're describing my granddaughter who feels the same way, you know, who tells me that she just wishes all humans would die so that the earth would have a chance to recover.
Yeah.
It must be even more intense for you because this is right in your face all the time. How do you deal with it? And what, if anything, gives you hope?
Oh, I don't deal with it very well. I don't live a very normal life. I really only work because I feel like I have to around the clock. And one of the most important people as a mentor and someone I look up to is Jane Goodall. And, you know, Jane, of course, got so famous and well known for sort of making it public that animals use tools. But then what she did was sort of shed all of her earthly desires and give her life to spreading conservation and hope, because she knew that those two things were the most important things that our world needs today. And so Jane Goodall travels something like 300 days a year, giving speeches every single night that she goes to a new city, talking to thousands, millions of people, trying to spread what she knows, that it's almost too late, but not too late. There's still hope. And that's it. She's just given herself to that. And so, for me, when I stand in a field of burning forest, I mean, you see the animals burning. When you look at the face of an elephant in many parts of India, you can see the stress. They're not happy. They're upset because their whole life they've been persecuted. They've been in danger. They don't know what it's like to be in a forest, you know, without the constant threat of humans, without the sound of chainsaws and motors and tourists. And it's very, very stressful. But, you know, I think that for those of us who are out there, you see, you know, because when I was a kid, one of the things I had was, you know, I said, is it really that bad? Is it really as bad as they all say it is? And I went out there and yes, it is. But the truth is like I said, with India, like there are more than ever, there are more people now waking up and trying to do stuff about it, that there is a chance that things could come back. I mean, I know, you know, whales, humpback whales went down to about 8,000 at one point, where they originally, before whaling, they were around 130,000. And we killed so many that it went down to about 8,000. We almost lost humpback whales, one of the most incredible things on our planet. And then people got together and they fought the whaling industry. They shut it down. And today we're back up to, I think, almost 90,000 humpback whales globally. I could be wrong, but that's the number that I last read. And it's like, they're back. In the 70s, we had rivers catching fire in Ohio and bald eagles were going extinct from DDT. People got together. They got organized. They said, we will not stand for this. And now the EPA has cleaned up so much of the country. Bald eagles are back. Nature will bounce back. It just takes us not being apathetic idiots to do it. So it's like we're still at that point but I do think we're the last generation that's going to have that opportunity, 100%. So, I mean, what I'm seeing in the Amazon, what I'm seeing in India is fueling all of this stuff that I'm doing. I mean, to me, this book is the only way that I can think of truly imparting the truth behind what I've seen.
Paul Rosalie. In addition to The Girl and the Tiger, he's the author of a memoir, Mother of God. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our extended interview with Rosalie, where we talk about his grief at the loss of nature, how he handles it, as well as the signs of hope he sees. We also have links to his conservation work and the video about the real elephant, Ramachandran. Check it out. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And please rate us on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using. It really helps to get the word out about this show. Thanks.